Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
Hello, everyone. I'm so excited to be here and see all your beautiful faces. This is our live Q&A for March, and we have a good group of people here. I have some questions that were sent in to us by people who couldn't attend. Obviously, if you aren't here, this will be our March Q&A that we'll be releasing this month, so you can still participate in a way.
Thanks for setting this up and whole podcast, everything. It's great.
We're explicit. You can say
Okay. I'm curious about at these cosmopolitan places like Byblos, where you've got all these different goddesses coming around to like Balak Gubal. What's it like between the different people involved with those? Like, are they celebrating together? Are they like, you know, how does that work? Either like abroad, like Byblos, or even like at some of the like international Baal Ashtart stuff in like Saqqara and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll jump in first, but I mean, one of the people to look to is UCLA alumna Danny Candelora, who works on connections between Egypt and West Asia. But, you know, when Herodotus went to Egypt in the fifth century BCE, he's like, their Amun is our Zeus, our, you know, like, and then the Romans are like, yeah, it's Jupiter. And there is this ability to make connections between divinities and to see similar archetypes and power structures from one divinity to another. There's also the really cool notion that you can have an outsider god. So a god like Seth is a war god, but he's also a storm god. In Egypt, in the Nile Valley, doesn't really have many storms, but there are storms out in the desert regions. There are storms in the Sinai. There are storms in West Asia, where you depend on rain-fed agriculture and rain-fed grasses and fruiting. So this god, this Seth, is like outsider and associated with Baal and is esteemed as having great power because he's an outsider, because he's not native to the Nile Valley. So that would work. But in the ancient world, gods were very much interchangeable, particularly the goddesses. But then it gets really competitive too, not so much in Egypt, but in West Asia. You invade a place and you steal their god. You bring their god to your temple and you're like, they're going to live with us now. And you treat them well and give them gifts and offerings and things like that until they're able to raise an army and steal their god back. It's one reason why in West Asia you have so much destruction of temples and temple spaces compared to Egypt, where you have temples more intact comparatively. But there's so much one could say about this this topic. But Jordan, what do you think?
It just makes me... if we're thinking of scholars who work, like Marion Feldman also works on this, and it's like international Koine pops up. So the kind of argument that, you know, in the late Bronze Age, like when Byblos is really big, that we're seeing, you know, the elites more broadly are interacting with each other. We start seeing, you know, certain motifs or span kind of Eastern Mediterranean. So the elites are competing against each other, right? And she goes through the various kind of more artistic references, you know, furniture and textiles we could talk about, things like this. So not so much ideological, but obviously that bleeds into it as well. And I think of that one Amarna letter, as Kara just referenced, of like the god going, one of the god statues, like going to visit Egypt or vice versa. And so kind of sharing these god statues.
And yeah, sometimes willingly. Sometimes you send them on a little expedition, diplomatic trip, you know? Yeah.
And obviously all the personnel for the god would have come with.
Yeah. So yeah, like, do we know about them, like, hanging?
No. But, I mean, you can... I feel like the Amarna letters, I feel like, are the most helpful resource for this. Like, you know, people from Babylon complaining about Akhenaten leaving their workers out in the sun for too long, right?
And they're diplomats, it seems.
Or maybe there's something we can extrapolate from, like, you know, when Hathor goes up to Edfu, like, is there something we can think, like, this would be their model that maybe would work on a more international
level? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really I would be interested in Kara's thoughts of like why the goddesses are the ones. Obviously, Hathor is the, you know, she's of the Eastern Desert. She's of the foreign lands. Like she's the goddess of outside of Egypt. But it is interesting that even like later in the Roman period, like Isis is the goddess that gets picked up kind of pan-Mediterraneanly. It's the goddesses seem to be much more palatable as something that like Ishtar gets, you know, picked up into Egypt. Obviously, like Set Baal becomes popular, but I feel like the goddesses, there's something more. Well,
so for the goddesses, I would say first, there's going to be within patriarchal society, arguably, and this is something somebody could work on and write books on, but there is arguably within patriarchal society more sameness of the female divinity. They're forced into particular archetypes that are much more restrictive, such that ancient patriarchal cultures around the world have the goddess who is calm and nice and motherly and soft, right, and then the goddess who is fucking pissed off and ready to destroy. And those two are interchangeable. It can sometimes be the same woman divinity figure. Sometimes you have different archetypal divinities that represent the violent version of the female versus the other. So there's that. But then the goddess getting sent abroad, I mean, that fits with the patriarchal structure too, in the same way that a harem is a way
to say, like marrying women. Yep.
Exactly. The elites are going to send their daughters to the court to marry the king. And they're probably instructing her, like, make sure you try to get his attention. Make sure when he comes in, you do this. Make sure, you know, there's probably all kinds of coaching to so that she can be impregnated with the king's seed and thus find more power with that. But she's sent off. And in so many patriarchal societies, the girl is sent off to the household of the husband. And she's then the emissary of the family. It is a diplomatic tie. And you could think of the same for the goddess being sent off to the home of the husband. Sometimes the husband visits, but it is true. Like there's Amun, a lot of goddess visiting.
Beautiful Beast of the Valley, yeah. Amun making his like route. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Think of, on a more local level, but yeah. Yeah. Brian, did you have something to say?
I was gonna just considering what Kara just said, how would that fit into the wandering goddess motif as well?
Mm-hmm. You mean
because here it's the wandering goddess who gets pissed off at her father, yeah, and she's the one who runs away.
Yeah.
Back to Nubia.
Well, he
arguably
sends
that's
her
where
away.
She's from. She's from
he
Nubia.
He sends
right?
her away too, but then she does run away and not come back. So this is like the wandering goddess would be the god's eye, the solar eye, or the destruction of mankind is what the text is often named in literature. And I believe the only attestation is in the tomb of Seti I. That's correct. And essentially the sun god is sitting there way above and looking at everyone and going, the people are rebelling at me. This is bad. And he sends out his eye, his agency, his action. Exactly. And she takes the form of a lioness and just starts gobbling people up and destroying. It's like the flood, but in a female archetypal, violent, pissed off, PMS, take no prisoners kind of form. And then she just kind of goes a little hysterical crazy. And I'm using the Greek word hysterical linked to the uterus on purpose, because it's something that is thought of as the passion of the female archetype that must be controlled through application, through gifts, sure, through in this case beer and music. So they have to lure her over to a lake they have manufactured filled with jars of beer that they've colored with red ochre to make it look like blood, and they're like, look, blood over here, and she's bubbling up the blood and becomes drunk and then softens back into the cat form, if you like, or the softer motherly form of herself. So it's interesting that in so many different mythologies, an uncontrollable rage, an uncontrollable emotionality takes a female form. And it is a very useful way of a patriarchal regime, and I've written about this, of saying that our emotions are all soft or all either anger or a blasé sort of blandness. And we don't have any other emotions. We're not allowed any other emotions. It's the woman, the female, the divine archetype that has all these crazy emotions. And all of that emotionality is dumped on her. Mm-hmm. But also when things go wrong, it's dumped on the female archetype as well. So much so that if you were in the ancient world in the reign of Amenhotep III and you're able to go to his temple of millions of years, you would walk into a court that had a sakmet for two sakmets for each day of the year, one for every 365 days and then additional ones for other propitiation. But one has the good fate and one has the bad fate. There's no either or. There's no nuance with these divinities. You either get good or you get bad, and you are trying to propitiate both of them. And these goddesses, they're the lioness, and they have these red eyes. And so you have this understanding of the female divine archetype being a bringer of pestilence, a bringer of woe, a bringer of disease. You know, the Pandora's box idea right. Then doesn't come from nothing. You know, there are originations. I'm not saying it's a direct thing, but there are originations to the female archetype being the source of ill health and problems and you know, passionate, over the top emotionality.
Yeah, so maybe the connection between the goddesses is more just patriarchal regimes and in the larger Eastern Mediterranean. But yeah, I mean, to be able to be one of the kind of craftsmen, traders, elite emissaries in Byblos or something would be, it'd be great to have a more on the ground view of this interaction in the late Bronze Age between all these players that we just get little glimpses of with, you know, objects, right? We're trying to take an object that we know was traded from Egypt, all this glass or something. We have to reconstruct all this stuff, or a letter here or there, or, you know, motifs that are traveling. But yeah, to know more about this larger interaction at that time would be.
But to Brian's point, this goddess is going to the south. She's going to Nubia. Yes, she's going to the source of the Nile. Mm-hmm. She's going to where the heat is. It's hotter there. It's drier. You don't have inundation. It's a place that's wilder without as much agriculture, more herding, more wild animals. The Egyptians knew that there were more hippos and crocodiles and lions and things to the south. So it's, you know, it's interesting to see that she herself has a foreign element as well.
Yeah. And I wonder too, I mean, we could go on and on about this, but like the concept of, unlike other cultures where it's Mother Earth, it's in Egypt, she's the female element is the sky and the earth element is the male. And so he's more rooted in the like land of Egypt, where the female element is always above you everywhere, right? The sky's everywhere. She's the Milky Way, the sky goddess, the cow goddess, right? So I wonder if that has a little bit to do with it as well. She's more ephemeral, more kind of omnipresent, but
I would agree with that, because there are oftentimes excerpts from, you know, kind of the map of heaven and earth where Nut is above, mm-hmm. Geb is below. I can't remember the name of the papyri, but there are only a few references where Geb's erection is present. Otherwise, he's just kind of laying down in a prone pose, yes. You know, kicking back, and he doesn't have an erection. So in my interpretation, he is more of a passive element until you get the Nile flood, and do you get that connection with Osiris, and of course, Isis as an agency of Osiris's resurrection.
Yeah, I mean, she's the one who molds his member back into being, and without her, you know, nothing would have happened. Yeah.
Member, very diplomatic of you.
I think the lack of an erect penis, I'll say it, for Geb is interesting too. Remember, Shu is holding them apart. If those two have sex again, the earth will collapse upon itself and kind of pre-creation state will be achieved. I don't think the Egyptians wanted that to happen. So I think drawing the erect penis is like, don't tempt fate. The sky would fall. The sky would literally fall. And we don't want that to happen. Mm. And you don't want another generation of the gods of discord. Right? Isis and Nephthys and Seth and Osiris, they just fight. And this is, you know, this is the discord that's brought discord to humankind as well, as above, so below. So it's, it's pretty
mutating faces. Yeah, I guess. Mm-hmm. Well, great question. Thanks, Samuel. Well, I can read the question we had sent in to us. Paul asks, and Kara, I think this is going to be a really easy one because it's about coffins. So I think you're okay.
You think that.
And they say, sorry. No, it's you're good. Paul asked and said, sorry, can't be there today. But can the contract work of tombs and coffins be imagined like the modern wedding industry? I think you've talked about this before. With a hired event planner arranging for the materials, material needs of the ceremony, Or did the Egyptian priests oversee things in a more direct, hands-on way? I'm thinking mostly about 18th dynasty era interments of private citizens. So how exactly does the funeral work for elites? How are they commissioning a coffin? I mean, see Kara's coffin commerce book, but lead us through it.
It's cheap. It's one of those Cambridge elements, and it's, I think it costs like $10 or something. It's a tiny little paperback, maybe less.
Now for a while, they were free PDFs too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can get this pretty easily. And I do compare the funeral to a wedding. But the questioner is more nuanced. But Paul is asking about when things are professionalized and when there's more care and attention taken by the commissioner versus care and attention taken by the professionals in charge of it. And that changes through time. We're talking about 3,000 years of elite burial. And I would encourage you to think of something like, you know, you think, oh, the elite has all the control. Elite doesn't have all the control. Just watch The Crown. As soon as whoever becomes the monarch, king or queen, the bureaucrats come in and they're like, my lord, you must do it this way. You must look in this box. You must hold the scepter and the orb this way. That professional could be a bureaucrat, could be a priest, pastor of some kind, bishop. It could be a diplomat. It could be all kinds of people. It could be an intelligence agent saying, you can't say this, you can't say that. And the elite is very much controlled. And so how a funeral works is very constrained because you want the dead to be transformed. You want the dead to come back to life. And for the elite funeral, you want the audience to have the understanding that this particular dead person has been transformed into something to whom they could also pray, a propitiate, a kind of superhero dead person that can act on behalf of everybody. And that the coffin and the burial and the tomb gives that elite dead person more power in comparison to maybe their own peasant father or mother. So you have to do it right. And your professionals are going to have to come in and they're going to say, we need to do this spell at this point, this spell at this point, put the dead in this container at this point, show them this way, we pour the black stuff all over them at this other point. And everything will be prescribed and organized. And as it's such an interesting thing to see, as time goes on in ancient Egypt, you can see the professionals taking over, such that by the time you get to the late period, you have these water corps, these people called wahmu, or the Kohakites in Greek, who have taken control of the game. Mm-hmm. And they give their profession to their son, and their son gives it to his son, and so on and so forth. And you have this group of professionals that have pretty much taken decision-making away from elites. And there's much more standardization in late period tombs. There's less elites able to create a really unusual tomb. It can't happen, but it's more difficult. So that's my answer for that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Weirdly, I was reading a book review, I don't know why, last night before I fell asleep, about this book about Victorian to Edwardian death rituals and like funeral and how they changed. And it made an interesting point about, you know, pre-modern societies in general. Obviously, this is very generalized. When the funeral, it's not so much about the person, like the heir being kind of front and center to show that continuity being established. But that in the Victorian period into the Edwardian, it kind of switches and more emphasizes, you know, it's more a commemoration of the individual who died and you're remembering them and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it was Victorian times. Egypt.
Yeah, when you carry around the lock of hair and the... No.
And it was talking about hair, and you have the professional mourners you pay to wear the all black, and we see professional mourners and in Egyptian...
People wore bracelets of their loved ones' hair braided up. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of... But, you know, death... The article, the review started with, like, in more modern times, if we're lucky, I think for most Americans right now, death is very separate from what we experience. Like a lot of people maybe go their whole life without seeing a dead body, you know?
Yeah.
But for people in pre-modern times, you know, death was much more present. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about it in that way. And
my grandmother, when she was 9 years old, and there she is right there, probably at the age of 16, 15 or 16, she came home from school, and this would have been in 1919 with the Spanish flu or whatever more politically correct term we want to give this epidemic. She came home and her mother was dead on the dining room table, just laid out. And everyone was around mourning and she was covered with black and the windows were covered with black crepe and everyone was there. And the body stayed on the dining room table for 3 days for a wake to make sure that the mother was dead. So you can you imagine, you know, you're a 9-year-old child and she was the oldest. But this experience of death was very formative for her. And she actually then at the funeral had to kiss her mother's body and was made to kiss her mother's body. And she did not want to. She's like, my mother's not there anymore. I don't want to kiss that. She had to kiss her mother's dead body in front of everyone before the body went into the ground. This is 3 days later after the wake, and traumatized her to no end, so, such that she told me about it. And then I asked more questions because, you know, who knew what I was going to do with it growing up? But these stories were very interesting to me. So yeah, exactly. You look very different. The person looks different. Their face sinks. They don't look like they used to look. After 3 days, I bet there was some smell. There was something that wasn't quite right. And I remember when my grandmother died when I was only 12 and they embalmed her. It had an open casket and put glasses on her. And I remember at 12 going, what's stupid? Why does she have glasses on? This is ridiculous. And I remember poking the glasses with my finger because, you know, Catholic Church, you have to kneel by the coffin and you're supposed to, you know, pray and think about death and all of these things. And I poked the glasses with my little 12-year-old finger going, the hell is that? And I was like, skin doesn't look great. This is weird.
Like, she doesn't need these glasses to see. Yeah,
exactly. And I remembered my grandmother's stories, you know, about death simultaneously. So, you know, this is just my tiny little experience. But we keep death far removed, far away. Even with COVID, we kept death far away. People died with professionals, without their family members there for the most part. And at the beginnings of it, we even separated people out, right? So it was, we need to bring death back into our lives, in my opinion. Yeah.
But
not a child kiss the dead person, perhaps.
Let everyone have a choice in how they want to deal with things. Yeah.
Yeah.
But for an Egyptian elite, they would presumably start planning for their death while they were living, right? They would commission a coffin, start developing these things. So, I mean, I think people do this today, right? You have a will, you start, maybe you put some money aside for your funeral, you lay out exactly what you want your funeral to be like. And so in that way, it's very, and maybe in that practice, it makes you kind of accept it more, right? You have, you know, you're going to be taken care of, you're helping your family. For the Egyptians, you know, your heir, you know, they're going to be giving the proper offerings, the money set aside, all these.
But planning this is still the role of the rich. If you don't have any money and you don't have any goods to pass down, you're not going to be thinking about your will. It's not uppermost in your mind. These are the things that the rich will be thinking of more than anybody else.
Yeah. Well, and then speaking of your forthcoming work about thinking about people breaking into your tomb and maybe robbing and reusing your things. That's probably not what they had planned either, right? So,
but we always clear the dead. I was just in England and we were at this little village called Horse Path.
Matte and Kylie were telling me about it. And they were like, Kara has an absurd knowledge of tombstone designs. And I was like, of course she does. Like, of course she knows Victorian tombstone styles.
I'm standing with the guy. I'm like, well, those are 17th century. He goes, why, you are correct. I'm like, yes, because it has the skeleton with the wings on the side. You can tell it's a 17th century tombstone design. And that was the oldest one in the graveyard. Yeah. And that's post-plague. And I said, oh, so this graveyard has been cleared. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, of course you would have cleared the graveyard after the plague. And you think of, you know, the catacombs in Paris where you have
gather the bones,
or something like that. You're not going to have that in an English parish church. It's not style. You don't want death to be that front and center, but they almost certainly would have cleared the graveyard,
put
the bones to a certain spot and then started again. What better time than the plague to opportunistically clear that area? And the guy was like, they wouldn't have cleared that. I'm like, they cleared this. You said this church goes back to 800. They've cleared it.
There were lots of dead people
who aren't going to fit in this little space. So
yeah. And for all the people who couldn't afford, right, like that the parish paid for them, they weren't given a tombstone. They definitely would have been the ones that when they needed some space, they collect their bones and put them somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Not even a coffin, but yeah.
Who has another question?
I mean, I can launch one at you if you want to be
go for it, Lexi,
with a question. We're here for
it. Okay. Well, I've been reading through the new Justinian biography. Really good. Highly recommend.
Who's the author?
Peter Saritz. It's this.
Oh, cool.
Beautiful one. Yeah. It came out just last year. So, it's really good. But you know, being a Byzantine period and everything, it talks a lot about images and their power. And so that got me thinking. And then, of course, I, you know, watched like the new Alexander documentary and a bunch of other stuff. The themes throughout a lot of these things that I've been reading and watching is like the power of images and how it was like a political power to be able to essentially like take and steal an image or a statue, right? That means so much to someone. And like take it away, essentially, you know, and you have famous stories from history, like you have the Athena Parthenos essentially being stolen out of Athens to sort of symbolize that they're conquered. And so I know in Egypt, there's a lot more destruction that happens rather than just like taking stuff like away. But I'm curious to know if either of you know of any documented times where like they would actually find more value in taking an image and like carting it to somewhere where it would be like taken.
What's that one statue that ended up in Nubia? It's like the 12th dynasty. Yeah, it's in the MFA. And yeah, it's a beautiful statue, but it ended up in Nubia, modern Sudan. And you know, people have all these various theories of how it ended up there. I think the prevailing theory is, you know, when the Nubians came up from the south and conquered Egypt and took control, that this was one of the booty items that was taken back, and it ended up in a tumulus of someone's tomb.
Beautiful piece.
It's a beautiful piece, yeah.
They did the one where they put it like in the steps into their like palace or temple thing too. They're like, every time I walk in, I'm gonna step on your...
Well, that one?
Oh, Senui. Yes.
Senui.
Yes.
That, the one where they're stepping on them is Caesar Augustus, Octavian as was, whose bronze head was found.
Yes, that one. Yep.
Which Nubian town was it in? I can't remember, but you step on it. You step on his head every time you walk past. And that's, I think it's Amarinus, the female ruler of Meroe, that is supposed to have, you know, conquered, defeated the Romans, and then taken this head and put it under their steps. I mean, that's pretty badass.
I
guess the best examples you've got for taking icons, statuary that represents divinities, in which divinities have been invited to dwell within, right? And these things being taken or messed with in some way would be Akhenaten's time period. And I think Nicholas Reeves has done the best argumentation that the section in Manetho that talks about God's shrines having been opened and their statues taken out and recommodified actually should be assigned to Akhenaten's Egypt rather than the period to which it is assigned. I think it's assigned to the late period. But I think that would be a reasonable thing. Akhenaten is not only starving the temples of wealth and funding, state funding, but he probably is also taking the wealth out of the temples and using them for himself, much like Henry VIII, when he divested the monasteries of power and control, took all of the wealth, gave the land to his elites, took all of the gold, jewels, silver, canina plates, et cetera, melted that shit down and used it to fund his regime and was very wealthy because of it. I mean, think of the Vatican. We go in there and melt that shit down. We're going to be doing pretty well and have a big upward rise in our income for a short period of time. So
makes me think too of, all that Middle Kingdom stuff ending up at Per Ramsey's. Obviously recarved multiple times. Like at some point someone was looting Lish or something like that, mm-hmm. and bringing a bunch of the nice stuff up to Pat Ramsey's and reusing.
No, Jordan, you're totally right, because a purpose-built capital city, you're going to have to build it fast.
And like, I need some sphinxes.
If you're building a purpose-built capital city like Itchitawi, right near the graveyard of Lish, and we still don't know where Itchitawi is. It hasn't yet been discovered, but it's nearby in the Fayum somewhere. And you want to create this purpose-built capital city that's going to serve your kingship, and you need to do it quickly with the gods and goddesses that people expect, not like Akhenaten's Egypt, then you would probably pull balustrades and architraves and temple columns and other things from Memphis or Heliopolis, statues, pull them into your purpose-built capital. And then when Itchitawi dies, those things then get brought to another place. So Pir Ramses is the Eastern Delta site where a lot of materials were brought to. And then after Pir Ramses gets silted up, where does everything go but to Tanis? And that continues, right? And you could argue that this is still happening in Sisi's Egypt with the capital city, the new capital having been built out in the desert. And while they're not pulling objects out there, I mean, they kind of are in some ways with antiquities, of which there is only one.
Antiquities around, you know, like at the airports in like Red Sea resorts, they're, you know, the White Queen or whatever her name was.
Yeah.
Moving stuff around too, in a way.
And the gem, well, it's not at the new capital city, is a capital city type building. And so everything's gotten pulled from the Cairo Museum at Tahrir and put into these different museums that are supportive of this capital city. And you could argue that they're like relics, you know, they're like the finger of St. John the Baptist or whatever, that somebody's gotten surrounded with gold and that gets taken by somebody who conquers this state and brought to their church, and then it gets taken to another place. It's a similar kind of thing. So if you have a very important object, I don't know, like Tutankhamun's mask, maybe, that's representative of state power and control and wealth and all kinds of power, you want to pull that from Tahrir and bring that to the new over-the-top giant thing wasn't on. Over-the-top giant museum and move things in that direction. Is that my sound is much better suddenly? Yes.
Yeah, you suddenly got very crisp.
Sorry. Mic was not. I was like, that thing is hanging out. And so, yeah.
Plunked it in. And as Samuel's sharing in the chat and stuff, yeah, once we get to the Christian period, it's a whole other, right, a whole other beast. And yeah, it's fun to look for reused blocks. I mean, if you just walk around modern day Cairo, you can just see so many reused blocks from things. Obviously for different reasons. It's just sometimes, you know, economically easier.
And all of that cladding stone from the pyramids, where did it go? It went to build medieval Cairo. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to find it? It's not going to be that easy. Limestone's very easy to work into something else. You're going to make it, you know, move it into all kinds of other blocks. But when it's a hard stone architrave or something like that, it's harder to rework that. And it's more expensive and you don't really need to. So you'll find granite architraves and stela and all kinds of blocks from Saqqara and Giza just in, you know, Khan al-Khalili or a mosque or, you know, the citadel, other places. So you want to be on the lookout for these reuses. And we shouldn't get angry. This is just the way people are, the way they have always been. As I always like to use St. Peter's Basilica as an example, creation is destruction. And there was a really old basilica there in the Vatican before, which Pope is it? Urban the Seventh or something like that. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Somebody can look it up. When the Pope decides, you know, we're going to hire Michelangelo to build a new magnificent church, and they do, but they have to take down the old one, which breaks my heart, but this is the way.
I believe it was actually Julius II.
Michelangelo
had a beef.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
His name's all over the front of it, right? To Samuel's point, there's so many great Coptic texts. When I was taking Coptic, of kind of their interactions, you know, they're monks living out in the desert in tombs or something like this, and they're seeing all this ancient Egyptian stuff. And so they're, you know, the demon Bes pops up in a lot of these Coptic, you know, they're ridding the temple of the demon. I think it's Seti's temple of like the demon Bes, and there's some spells being said. And so, yeah, the interaction between these monks living in a lot of these, you know, used to be Egyptian temples that get turned into monasteries. Their interactions are really, really interesting. Yeah.
And the transition once the Romans, you know, anoint Christianity becomes like, you know.
You go through Dendera and you carve out all the people except the ones at the top because you can't reach those, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is striking that most of your examples are within Egypt but they had that interesting relationship. I mean, it's just interesting because a lot of the stuff that I've been reading about is definitely more not in transit, the same country.
I mean, you can think of
more
like
as a political statement.
Think of all the obelisks that aren't in Egypt, right?
I think more obelisks outside of Egypt than in Egypt. You can think of the Pantheon is built out, purposefully built by Hadrian out of the stones of his realm.
Yeah.
And they're all reused.
And so you can keep doing this for forever.
And all the objects that aren't in Egypt that are currently in mostly Western countries, arguably, is the same phenomenon happening just in a more modern sense. So,
and in the Pantheon, there is a statue of the Virgin Mary. And if you look at her sandaled foot, you can see that she was a goddess or an elite woman, and that it was transformed into the Virgin
Mary. This. Yes, when they like recarved it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I did that in Out of Egypt way back when. And it was the expert of the Pantheon who showed me this. So that was pretty fun.
Jeff, no remember what episode that was?
I went back and find it. For the Pantheon and reuse. I can't remember. I can't remember. Yeah. There's only six of them, Lexi. So
I know. So I'm like, well, I guess I have a good reason to go rewatch all six because I got to find it now.
Yeah. I know. Don't. But yes.
I was actually disappointed that there were only six. I thought it was a really interesting program.
No, I had a lot of fun making it. But Out of Egypt, you know, the amount of work and time that I put into that was pretty extraordinary. And I had just gotten the professorship at UCLA and I could not do both. There could only be one, like in out. What is it? There can only be one. Highlander. Yes. So I had to choose. I had to choose between my job at UCLA or a TV show. And, you know, TV shows are very short-lived. And you're at the whims of an executive. And I decided that professorship was the way to go. And someday, I was just talking with a friend of mine. I was like, we should do something. You and I just wander around the world with our iPhones and talk and plan something out. He's like, that would be great fun. But so maybe someday, when my son is older than 13, 14, I'll be able to go out into the world and have these kinds of conversations. But, you know, more on the cheap. We'll see. No one's going to pay for that kind of show anymore. It's over.
Yeah.
It's over.
I'll talk about aliens. So,
yeah.
Well, never too late to go make whatever you want now. More freedom, too.
Yeah, probably.
But I do want to get to Noir88's question in the chat. So how do you explain Ma'at to your students? This is a hard one. Learning about the Middle Kingdom at this moment right now and the propaganda the elite fabricated about the first intermediate period. So this literature that pops up where the poor become rich and the rich become poor, social swap. Yes, I actually just was reading through that because they talk about clothing, like, oh, the poor are wearing really nice linen and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And that there was no order, that Ma'at, right, was out of order. Every time I hear talk about Ma'at, they mention justice or truth. But to me, it sounds like Egyptian when they talk, they're more talking about social order, not so much justice.
Yeah. So I've written about this at length in my most recent popular book, The Good Kings. And I actually talk about the eloquent peasant as a wonderful example of this, because this poor peasant is set up by some rich dude who is getting
his linen on the road.
And so the peasant has to go around and then he's like, you walked on my land and ate corn and I'm going to put you in jail and now I'm going to take everything from you. And he's the eloquent peasant because he has to plead his case over and over again using the tenets of Ma'at. And the text is very open about the fact that Ma'at is misused by elites, by the wealthy, to create law and order. And I want you to have the hackles raised when you hear that phrase, to create a status quo and a power for themselves such that they can exploit and remove wealth from people who are less than them. It means that the Egyptians were, because it's the eloquent peasant, he gets before the king. He's about to commit suicide. He's lost his whole life and family, everything. I mean, the poor guy. He finally gets to the king and pleads his case. And the king is like, oh, yes, let him go. But like they made him dance is my point. They made him go through all of this turmoil. And it is a way of proving Ma'at and that Ma'at still stands. I mean, if that's the Ma'at of a patriarchal complex society, which I think we all know because we live within it, I think we know how this works, right? That Ma'at, whatever truth and justice and balance is, serves the rich. Now, I don't want to say that Ma'at as an originating idea of truth and balance is not existence, in existence, or something to strive for, or something that
that all of us aren't trying to reach, but it can so easily be co-opted and exploited and misused. So when I teach it, it's, you know, the words like law, you hear the word law. Okay, that's good. We need laws, right? For everyone to get along. What about order? Well, you need order. You don't want anarchy, right? So that everyone can get along. All of a sudden, you put law and order together. Yes, it was a TV show, but it was also this idea that the state is going to oppress you and is going to use law and order, or the elites are going to use law and order to keep you in your place. And I think we can all easily code shift and move between understanding that there is a good to these things and understanding how it can also be exploited, and how people are not allowed to march, not allowed to have free speech, not allowed to have civil disobedience. Not allowed to speak out over the atrocities in Gaza, for example, at universities across the land, because it's anti-law and order. And those kinds of things are alive and well in our society as they were in ancient Egypt. So I teach it like that. and then the discussions ensue.
And I think the, you know, Ma'at often gets contrasted with Isfet, like chaos or disorder or something. But like you can't have one without the other, that there's this idea of like this balance also in holding that, you know, it can't just be all good, 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 order, 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 but that there's, you have Ma'at because you also have Isfet and vice versa. But again, I think it's often just used as a form of control because you say, oh, that's not Ma'at, or the king is the one who's, you know, perpetuating Ma'at, and, or if the king's a bad king, he's not doing Ma'at, it's your rationale for getting rid of him, you know.
Right.
It's like laws, like we make them up. There's no, and they can be obviously, who are they serving? Who are they objectifying? All these.
I find your point, Jordan, interesting, because if you look at the concept of Ma'at versus Isfet, Isfet is never really personified
as
like a deity.
It's not a goddess. Yeah.
Seth is Isfet.
Seth is as close as we can get, or maybe even Apep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Egypt is arguably more keen to cleave to Ma'at. This is not a place where big anarchic moves will reward you as much as West Asia or the Italian peninsula or Greece, you know, where a big assassination attempt and a big power shift could easily move a competitive faction into place. In Egypt, because of geographic boundaries, because of the way society works, because of the river and the way it contains and controls people, this is arguably a place that is more interested in status quo maintenance and risk-averse social living, such that anarchic powers are not rewarded in the same way. This is not to say the Egyptians didn't see great power in Isfet. It is Seth who is on the prow of the sun god's bark when he meets Apophis. It is Seth who spears him. It's that anarchic violence, that like chaotic good, I suppose, or just chaotic neutral for Seth, that's going to be able to take down this kind of beast. You need it. You can't not have it. So everything is a combination of the two, but then you're supposed to find this balance again. I think for Egyptians, and one of the reasons that The Eloquent Peasant was written and the way people are working through it is, how much Ma'at is too much Ma'at, and when do you need to stir shit up? And I think it's something that we're dealing with today. It's something that everyone is talking about. When is civil disobedience what is absolutely needed? When is stirring something up with an extraordinarily overt and fiery comment exactly what is needed for people to wake up and see things different? When is something like self-immolation, for instance, going to make somebody pay attention to something they did not before? I mean, it's a very interesting tension between the two, and the Egyptians tried to work with it. They dealt with it in the same way that we do as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Marissa's comment in the chat, it's like when you see someone shoplift baby formula, you're like, you know, there's rules. And then you're like, well, if you need baby formula that bad, like you should be able to, you know. You could think of where's our social safety net and stuff like this.
Yeah, I think it's kind of related to that. We have this, I think a lot of people have this idea that maybe the lower, I don't want to say like class, because that wasn't really like a structure back then. But you know what I mean? Like we're somehow fully believing or beholden to these beliefs. And I was wondering if there's anything that indicates, like, we have these discussions where we doubt the people in power and we question their decisions. And I can't imagine that being much different back in the day. But what is there any evidence for that? What is there anything that survives where, like, kind of the regular people are like, yeah, that's what they say, but, you know, we got to go harvest and we got to go get on with our lives.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, no, yeah. I mean, you're asking about civil disobedience. You're asking about social pushback and you're asking about things like revolution. There's a bigger word that I use in my writing and I can't.
Even just like dissent or just like
dissent,
not...
but it's a.
Yeah.
Fine.
Like questioning but, things. Yeah.
But you need a social basis. So you use the word class, and class is an excellent word when you have an upper class, a middle class, and a lower class. And you arguably do not have this in Egypt until you have the beginnings of an industrial revolution. Maybe in the at the late period into the Greco-Roman time period, then you could argue you have a middle class that has a basis of power, which they can use to create civil disobedience, discord, dissent, to actually push back against power structures. If you are a farmer and you're a peasant, you're a sharecropper, you're renting somebody else's land, your civil disobedience, your anarchic dissent will result in your and your family's starvation. So your landholder elite has a lock on you in ways that are completely unfair, but it creates a serfdom reality. And one of the ways that ancient peoples found to dissent would be to just leave the place, go off walking someplace else. And this is why so many ancient tales have discussions of peoples on the move, 40 days and 40 nights to the Sinai, going back to the homeland, people migrating and finding new spaces, late Bronze Age collapse, all these people coming from the Northern Mediterranean and moving around the Eastern seaboard and coming into Egypt. So there's only so many options if you don't have a middle class with a social foundation of power. And revolution or bread riots or something like that is something you really don't get until urbanism expands in ancient Egypt. And I would say, you know, at places like Alexandria, you do have evidence for it. You do. So until you get different classes, I like to use the word status group. And if you have a very pyramidal social structure of high elites, and then most people down below are of a much lower peasant-based status group, it's going to be very hard to create that kind of social disobedience.
Yeah. I like to think about, too, like, we're raised in a society where we have those rights and privileges to engage in such things. And so it's an option. We see it as an option for us. But in a society where that's not even an option, or you don't even see anything coming out of it, right? It's just, it is whatever, the water that you drink. I think Kara always uses the term. And I think if you were going to have an issue with someone, it would probably be like your immediate boss, not the pharaoh, right? The pharaoh is so probably disconnected from just some random farmer in Middle Egypt. We're just so interconnected now with the internet, like with newspapers and all these things. We can know what our president's doing all the time and all this kind of stuff. But if you're just a farmer in Middle Egypt, what actual level of interaction are you having with the elites or the government in power? You're paying your taxes. You know, maybe you're complaining about the guy taking, you know, too much grain from you, and you're maybe dealing with like very local type of dissent or something like this. But I doubt you're thinking about like your society writ large, like having these types of discussions like we have. Like, I would also say
that these discussions that we have are limited to educated middle class
exactly.
And upper class.
Like, how many people do you know that are just complacent and happy with capitalism, and they're just like, I'm just living my life, watching TV at night. And
or they're working three jobs and they're busting it, and they don't have time to learn about any politics or march in the streets or create civil disobedience, because the social inequality has grown to such an extent, to a yawning wide gap between the richest of the rich and everyone else, that if you quit one of your three jobs, then all of a sudden you're going to be living in your car. And if that's your civil disobedience, like the sharecropper, you will do nothing. And that kind of, so I'm not,
I don't want to say, okay, we're fucked. There's nothing you can do. No one's going to ever speak out against systems of power. Those systems of social inequality can grow so wide that they can also break. And they could do that in the ancient world as well. And you can see it. So you can see first intermediate period texts, the instructions of Ipuwe or Anctifi's tomb, where society and social contracts have really broken. And it takes, and you have a leveling of society. And yes, you get people who are poor wearing rich people's clothing and people stealing my catalytic converter. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, this is how society is rebalanced and how you get a social leveling. So it did happen in the ancient world too. And one of my favorite books for this is written by James C. Scott, and it's called Weapons of the Weak. And he works in Malaysia, and he talks about how the poor have their methods. They have their methods of working badly, working slowly. If they're going to, they could create a surplus, they're going to create so great a surplus. And the elites and the owners of the land will be like, wow, we're not treating our workers well. Or they see that that landholder is treating his workers like shit, is getting way less in surplus than he is, and he's treating them better. But there are ways for people to dissent. And there's also theft. Theft is one of the most useful ways of rebalancing society. And the poor can steal things whenever and however they want. And I think in California, the home of the homeless and extraordinary social inequalities, you drive from my neighborhood to Beverly Hills or whatever, you see why theft is a way of rebalancing society. And I read my neighborhood, what's that stupid app called?
Like Nextdoor.
Nextdoor. And people are like, oh my God, this was stolen. My car was broken into. I mean, what do you think society's going to do when you have this amount of social inequality? Theft is a rebalancing. It is a way of dealing with it. And your poor sharecropper could steal from the temple, from the elite, from that, you know, there are all kinds of ways that things can happen. And that there can be a social cohesion. I remember in Weapons of the Weak, there's this discussion about one of the elites, one of the landowners gets a really nice motorcycle. And all of a sudden, the motorcycle is just gone. And everyone knows that the motorcycle was taken for parts. And the elite can't even complain. He can't even go to the police. He knows he can't go to the police. He knows that he's not treating his workers well. And his motorcycle has just been sold off for parts. And there's nothing he can do. And so there are ways to dissent. And even if you can't have a big revolution, there's going to be stuff you can do.
Well, and it seems that's the way to get the attention of the people in power, right? In LA, all they talk about is, oh, this Louis Vuitton got broken into and all these stupid bags got stolen. Like, you know, they're not thinking about like the cause of all this. They're just worried about the store that generates a lot of money is getting broken into and now we need more police and blah, 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 blah. Like that gets their attention more than, oh, that there's a lot of unhoused people on our streets and like, you know, why, how do we solve that problem? It's like, no, let's think about like CVS is getting broken into and like closing down or something.
And in the same way that police in our society are there to protect private property of the people in power, in the ancient world, it is the same. And when you see Magi, the word for police in the New Kingdom, for example, it is there to protect the property of the king because they're in the Valley of the Kings. It is there to protect the property of the elites. It is there to maintain that kind of ma'at, distribution of power and wealth. It is not to provide law and order for the entire society.
You gotta ask who's Maat, right?
Yeah.
Great. Well, we're right about time. That went by so fast. I'm really happy with all these. These were really great questions, and thank you all for taking time out of your Saturday to hang out with us for a little bit.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack, Ancient Now, at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters.
I'm at all the social medias. Look for at Kara Cooney. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.